Thought it might be good to just show you on the screen a little very serious scientific experiment that helps people to understand just how tired and exhausted they might actually be. I'm going to show you a picture of two dolphins. And it's very easy, very explainable. Now, if you see anything else on this screen but two dolphins, you are in a very serious state of exhaustion. And so watch this picture very carefully to see whether you qualify. Why do I get the impression we're in serious trouble here? What word or what idea or what theme did you hear in the first hour that was most important to you personally? If, for example, we had to close this whole day down right now and head back out of here and go home, would there be anything in the first hour that you would take with you and say, gosh, there were a lot of words, but this is the one thing I've got to think about or I've got to wrestle with or that I find significant? Give me a word, a sentence, a theme. Very, very quickly, I'd like to hear from any number of you. Just sound off and tell me. What'd you hear that provoked you?
Listen to stories.
That's a great start. Thank you.
Transparency.
Thank you.
Self-care.
I like that phrase.
Sustainability.
Doesn't that word make you feel good just to say it? It sounds so contemporary. The sustainable life. Say that again.
Include the struggles and not just the successes when telling stories.
The struggles must be part of the story, absolutely. Thank you for that.
Heroes.
If we had days and days together, I might say, would you please go off for an hour and list the 5 to 8 heroes that have marked your life? It's one of the good reasons for reading biography. Every third book we read ought to be a biography. That's just my opinion. Gail thinks it's every fourth book, but I think it's every third. Somebody else.
Honesty.
Great.
Grace.
Don't quit. Thank you. You don't have a quitter's gene in you, do you? You don't look like you have a quitter's gene.
Knowing who you are.
Knowing who you are. Thank you. A few more. Where you come from is important. Thank you. Do they do that in New Zealand? Do they have reflection time?
Watch your life and
document. Is that a great line? Anybody else? You know, you're all a bunch of hypocrites. You sat here, and let me use that word over and over again, and nobody signaled the slightest sense of confusion or dismay about the word. You just let me think you understood exactly what I was saying. Now you know why your congregations look at you with glazed eyes.
In much of rural New Zealand, rotary refers to a cow shed.
That must have got your imaginations running. Any more? Anybody else with anything to say? I'm sorry?
Grace. Wholeness of yourself.
Wholeness of self. Wholeness. Yeah, great word. Yeah. Well, you did pretty good. Pretty good without having lunch. Let me take you in a few different directions to set the stage for what we might talk about in this next hour. In America, we had a great Methodist evangelist by the name of E. Stanley Jones, who for about 50, 60 years crisscrossed India particularly, but really crisscrossed the world with a message of the gospel that was heard through his lips by kings and princes. He was a great, great man of God back in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, wrote probably 50 books. At the age of 83, he had a terrible stroke, which left him virtually paralyzed and unable to speak. You can imagine as a preacher and a traveler what this would mean. You would have thought that the stroke would have been the end-all, and yet E. Stanley Jones managed to write another book called The Divine Yes, which, if you can find a copy of it, is well worth reading. It can be read pretty quickly. Probably not his best book, but it has insights that are really worthwhile. But here's a man who can barely mumble the words to a book into a tape recorder so that somebody else can translate it into to print. And he reflects upon his experience, and this is what he says at the age of 83. "There are scars on my faith, but underneath those scars there are no doubts. Christ has me with the consent of all my being and with the cooperation of all my life. The song I sing is a lifelong song, not the temporary exuberance of youth that often fades when middle and old age sets in with their disillusionment and cynicism. No, I'm 83, and I'm more excited today about being a Christian than I was at 18 when I first put my feet upon the way." Now, the value of those words come alive to me when I realize this is a man who's lost virtually all of his physical faculties, who's staring the end of life squarely in the face, will perhaps never be able again to do all the things that's kept him so vital for 50 or 60 years, stripped down to little more than what the soul has to offer. And yet these words just drip with enthusiasm. I put this up here because I'd like to create for you the specter of seeing this is the way we all ought to think and believe when we reach such an age. I told you that when 20 years ago, there was a moment when my life, and of course Gail's with me, went into free fall, and where there was no sense of a future for a moment. I never want to relive those moments ever again for any reason in the world. But the lessons learned in those dark moments will last a lifetime. I have vivid memories of a September Sunday morning that year, 1987, sitting on the edge of our bed. Gail had already gone to the living room to get the day started, and I was sitting there thinking about the fact that there was really nothing to do. And I switched on the television set to make a bit of noise, and there came the face, perhaps you've seen him here in New Zealand, of Robert Schuller, whose ministry I've admired, I suppose, but not as a serious devotee. And he suddenly said, "I'm going to preach to you about enthusiasm." And I said out loud, kind of cynically, "Whatever else do you preach about?" And then he said, "Enthusiasm, listen to this, it's a very interesting sentence. Enthusiasm," Schuller said, "is an energy manufactured in the soul, which is oblivious to the circumstances around it." I thought about that for a moment, and I realized that for many years, when people talked about me, they characterized me as a man of enthusiasm. They would say, "Gordon's always got a fresh idea. Don't hang around for very long because he'll give you something to do." And Gail sometimes would smile and say, "Yes, and his ideas are very expensive." But I loved hearing those things about me. I loved that people thought that I was an enthusiast, a visionary, an idea person. But what was so stunning to me that morning as I listened to Schuller was the realization that I hadn't heard people saying that about me in the more recent past. It was factual. I had lost my enthusiasm. I'd lost my vision. And the big question then came, what am I living on? And the answer came back to me, I'm living off Gail's enthusiasm these days. If there's any vision in our home, if there's any enthusiasm, it's hers. And I'm warming myself off of her fire, like a neighbor who has lost his wood supply. And I went out and we talked about this for a while, and I had to say to my wife, I apologize to you. I've been drawing off your enthusiasm for myself in these last weeks and months. And I don't know whether, if you've lost your enthusiasm, whether you can get it back.
but if you can get it back, I'm going to try. And that was the turnabout for me. That was the day that life began to move in a different direction. As I began to ask the question, what happens when a person loses the thing that they've been living for these many, many years? Can they get it back? Oswald Chambers has a very, very powerful entry in his journal, which he writes just months before he dies. He says, "A great fear has been at work in my mind, and God has used it to arouse me to prayer. I came across a man whom I knew years ago, a mighty man of God. And now 10 years have gone, and I meet him again, and he is garrulous and unenlivened." We don't use those words in the U.S. very often. They're kind of Victorian English. But the word garrulous generally means someone who's superficially chatty. They say a lot of stuff that doesn't mean much. They're kind of empty of spirit. And unenlivened, as best as I can translate the word, means the man is dead in soul. He just has nothing to offer. There's no energy. There's no vitality. Chambers goes on and he says, "How many people seem to become like that after 40 years of age? The fear of laziness and a loss of discipline has come home with a huge fear and fairly driven me to God to keep me from ever forgetting what I owe him." In the course of Gail's life and mine, we spend a lot of time with younger men and women in Christian ministry. It's a large part of our call today to try to be father, mother, if you please, to younger people. When you do that, you begin to see how frequently people begin to lose their vitality somewhere in their mid-40s. And Chambers writing this 90 years ago, Chambers writing this is so prophetic as he asks the question, how many people lose their energy or their enthusiasm somewhere at this 45th, 46th year of life? My magic number is 47. It's amazing to me how many people who kind of fall into this trap are about 47 years of age, living off other people's enthusiasm, just trying to get through life without getting hit on the head, as it were. And so that was my mourning in September of 1987, loss of enthusiasm. How do you get it back? And one of the things I did in response to my own question was, I don't know why I did this, it just somehow happened. I took out a pad and I began to list all the old men I knew. And I made this long list of old men in their 70s and 80s. And I looked at that list and asked what was true about these old men. And the first thing that came to me, and I don't mean to sound disrespectful or mean, because I'm awfully close to that now, was I didn't like most of these old men. They were not pleasing to be around. They were not the kind of folks that if you had an evening out, you would invite to join you for sheer pleasurable company. They were self-centered. They were fixed in their ways. They tended to resent younger people and younger ways. They tended to want to hold on to things, to power if they'd been leaders. And it was things like that that contributed to a soul that just wasn't pleasant. Garrulous and unenlivened are Chambers' words. Then in the list, I noticed that there were 4 or 5 men that were utterly different, that you would kill to be with, that you'd go any distance to spend an evening or a day with. And I asked myself, what did I like about those people? And I came up with 8 or 9 answers. I noticed that they were men who were perpetually thankful. They walked through life thanking everybody and God for every little thing that happened in life. Nothing was too great or too small to be thankful for. Another mark I noticed about them was that they loved their wives. That you could tell when you were with them that there was a little code that went on between the two that you couldn't decipher, but you knew what the bottom line was. It was all about love. The twinkle in their eyes, the way they touched each other, the little words they used of endearment that were just private between them. Their marriages, their personal relationships were fresh and growing, even at that age. A third thing I noticed about them was that they were men who had learned the power of prayer. They no longer needed organizational power. They were men of wisdom, men of prayer, men who understood that this was a deeper, longer-lasting power than the other kinds of power they had used in earlier years. I noticed that they were men who loved fresh ideas. They were up on the newest literature. They knew what was going on in the world, and they delighted in changes that made a difference. Then I noticed that they were men who delighted in the success of younger people. And they did everything they could to urge on new generations to take their place in leadership and did everything they could not to hold them back. And I said to myself almost 20 years ago, that's the kind of man I want to be if God allows me to live into my 80s. Now I tell you that story because the lesson I learned from my own experience is this. That as life wears on, it will only become increasingly effective for the person in public ministry if he or she always has a bigger picture in view of what they want to become and where they believe God conceivably could lead them. What happens to men and women in their 40s is that all too often we lose the big picture because it's getting blasted to pieces time after time with obstacles and difficulties. So we lose the picture, and the next thing you know, we're just taking one step at a time, day by day, not really knowing where this journey is leading us. In the U.S., we call this bunny tracking. On a morning when the snow has freshly fallen and you follow a bunny or a rabbit across the field, you will see it just darting all over the place. Bunny tracking, we call it. There's no sense of direction to it. It's just instinct impulse. And that's what happens too often in ministry, is people living by instinct and impulse, just trying to keep alive one more day, to collect a paycheck for one more week, because we lose the big picture. It leads me to these kind of questions. Where do you want to be in 20 years? What do you want God to be using you to do 10 years from now? What kind of a person do you want to be? What would you like your marriage to look like several years from now? Where do you see your sense of call going? These are all long-range questions which help life to fall into alignment with something that makes sense, which makes it possible for a person to do their best work in their 50s, their 60s, and their 70s, which is what I covet for you and I covet for myself. With those thoughts in mind, let me introduce you to what I'm simply going to call a wheel that lists some of those key exposures I talked about in the first hour, where a leader is made or broken, depending on how he or she handles these issues. If I were to take you into a list of the big exposures around the wheel, I'd start, first of all, right here. And I would say an effective leader in public life who really is an agent for life change is a person very much aware of his or her conversion and call. Now you'll notice that I have belted these two words together as almost one flowing concept, which I'm convinced is true, particularly for men and women in leadership. When Paul was converted, presumably on the road to Damascus, in that incredible encounter with Christ and what happens in the next days in the house in Damascus. When he is converted, if you read his conversion, you will see that his conversion and his call are virtually knitted together in a seamless sense. The call is part of the conversion. Now, I don't want to argue that theologically and make a big deal out of it, but I would just suggest to you that in the leader's life, the two really need to be strung together with this notion in mind that they are not events which happen just in a one-time moment, but they are things which are flowing dynamically throughout the leader's life. Back in the 17th century, there was a man by the name of Thomas Shepard. He used to say to his congregation with regularity, it was a Puritan congregation, "Be converted, and always converting." Here's where I may get in trouble with a few of you. I think too many of us were brought up in a theological tradition where the notion of conversion was always treated as a, can I say it this way, a photographic event in the past that we look back to. I was converted, we say, in 1973. I was converted in 1985. I was converted in 1996. And we look back at some event, a Billy Graham campaign or something we saw on television or a book we read or a vacation Bible school or a summer camp, whatever it is, I was converted there. But what if we go back to the New Testament and, or to the whole Bible, I shouldn't have said the New Testament, and look at conversion from a totally different perspective. For example, what if we step away from the conversion of Paul, Saul of Tarsus, and we look for a moment at the conversion of Abraham? Because these are two very interesting, contrasting conversions. I would like to argue that the conversion of Abraham will be the greater model of conversion in the 21st century than the conversion of Paul. What did Paul convert from? Well, he certainly converted from the hatred he had toward the Christians. But he knew, in one sense, the God of Israel better than anybody. He knew the Old Testament scriptures, probably had it, most of it memorized. He was a very moral person in most senses. So what did conversion mean for Paul? Well, it probably meant you slip out the motherboard of the law of Moses and you slip in the motherboard of the love of Christ and poof, you've got a converted person. But Abraham's another story. Abraham grew up in total paganism. Whole different view of reality. He has to leave his soil, his family line, his core competencies that he learned as a boy in his father's clan or household. He has to go to a land that's totally strange to him. And for, I'm going to guess, 35 years, he has to learn one lesson after another that moves him into a total ambiance of faith. It's only on the top of the mountain when he lays Isaac, his most prized possession in all of life, on the altar, that heaven says when the knife is raised, stop, now I know that you fear God. So that Abraham's conversion, in effect, is being celebrated over a 35-year period. I think what Abraham is teaching us is that conversion is not only that moment when I become aware that I have trusted my life to God through his son Christ at the cross, but the conversion also is something which is a lifelong process that takes greater and greater possession of all of whom I am as a person. When one begins to see conversion in that larger sense, not only of center point, but flow, then that brings to the spiritual leader a whole new sense of spirituality, because every day I awaken to deepen my conversion. I become aware that for a lifetime, the hand of God is going to have to be dealing deeper and deeper with me and changing me, processing me more into conformity to the image of Christ. That means in my congregation or my organization, I must always be first converter. People must see, as Paul says to Timothy, watch your life and doctrine, so that all men may see your progress. He could have said, so that all men see your continuous, ongoing conversion. Very important thing for us to ponder, that we have been converted, but we are always in a state of converting. My fear is 20 years into leadership, a lot of us forget this. And we allow ourselves to become hardened. And our view of the Christian life and our own journey becomes something that is so solidified that it has very little growth room. Paul says to the Philippians, chapter 3, I'm paraphrasing, I want to know Christ better and better. I want to know him so well that I'm in the fellowship, I'm sharing his sufferings, I even go through his death and I experience the glories of his resurrection. And you said to yourself, here's this old guy who's probably not far off from his own execution. And he's still saying, I want to convert in my knowledge of Christ greater and greater and greater. He never stops growing. Never stops growing. Too many of us stop growing. We live off the spirituality we learned in our teens and our 20s. But when you're 45 and 57, you need a new spirituality that keeps you growing through the new issues that are rising in each decade of your life. The other dimension of this point, as we go to this wheel, is the importance of the call. Because most of us here in this room would probably have a call story. Some place in life where we were aware that God said, I don't want you to be an operator of a bulldozer. I don't want you to drive a bus. I don't want you to be a newspaper reporter or a computer programmer. I want you to be a minister of the gospel. I want you to be a person who is set apart to lead people to the Savior and to help them to grow, to form churches, whatever it is you do. You do it because you're called. You don't do it for the money. You don't do it for the prestige, although that may be a little bit of the twist in our motives. But you do it because you believe you were called. What is your call like? How fresh is your call? Because if your call is not vitally real to you, if it's not updated, if it doesn't have a fresh impact upon you today, as it would theoretically have had the first day you heard it, then your call begins to lose its grip upon you. And I would suggest to you that freshness in Christian leadership is highly dependent on how deeply you believe in the present tense of your call. If you think about it, every time Paul opens his mouth and tells his story in the book of Acts, he always goes back to his call story. His call seems to be as significant to him as even his understanding of salvation. It keeps him going. It's the strength behind his willingness to suffer. He will pay any cost to fulfill his call. And those ringing words, "Wherefore, O King Agrippa, I was not disobedient to that heavenly vision," which was the call to be a witness both to the Jews and the Gentiles, to speak to kings and princes, and he would pull any trick he could to fulfill that sense of call. My observation as the old guy, I hear relatively few conversations among Christian leaders today about their call. And I say to myself, this could be one of the secrets that underlies our fatigue, maybe even a bit of our boredom, of our feeling trapped, is that we have forgotten the life-giving power of the call. The call. The American monk Thomas Merton, who's been dead now for a number of years, reflects upon his call. If you want to identify me, he says, ask me not where I live, or what I like to eat, or how I comb my hair, but ask me what I think I'm living for. Ask it in detail. In other words, Merton wants to tell us his story. Ask me what I think is keeping me from living fully the thing I want to live for. Between these two answers, you can determine the identity of any person. The better answer he has, the more of a person he is. There's a lot of substance to that paragraph. I think about this paragraph often when I get into conversations with people that you want to be with, and then you go away an hour or two later. It's not that every conversation has to be deep and philosophical or theological or very heavy, but you would think over a period of time when you're in the presence of a man or a woman in Christian leadership that sooner or later the conversation would move in substantial directions about ideas, about challenges, about visions. Merton is saying, until you tell me what you're living for, what you're called to, I'm not sure I'm really going to know the real you. So it makes me ask, what are our call stories? And how much of our call is alive to us in the present tense? I write for the Christianity Today organization, who's has one of its publications, Leadership Journal, and so for the last several years, I've had the privilege of having an article in each edition, and then, and I'll show you this later if you're interested, their website, which is renewed every month. They have a column on every month. But about 2 or 3 years ago, the editor said to me, "We'd like for your next article to be on the subject of call, because we are afraid that in public ministry, in modern times, men and women are forgetting the importance of the call. We're hearing more about career and less about call." So I set out to write this article, and I got it written. And when I was through, I turned it in, and they said, "Thank you, this is what we wanted," and it went off to be published. And then I got thinking, gosh, what is my call story? I've written about call, but what about me? And I realized in the article that when I reflected upon myself, my whole call story was about old things that happened way back then. I talked about my mother and my grandmother praying over my cradle. I talked about the call to ministry I responded to 25 times in church when they asked young people to come forward. Talked about my call when I was a college student and when Gail and I met and finally realized that we would be in pastoral ministry for most of our lives. I told about that. But then I realized that my call story was more than 25, 30 years old. And I began to say, maybe my call needs to be updated or refreshed. So I began to pray, "Lord, would you please give me a new sense of call? I'm 65 years of age. I've got to have a new call. Do you call 65-year-old people to anything of importance?" And day after day, in one way or the other, I prayed that kind of a prayer. I went off to Germany about that time to speak at a number of pastors' conferences, and it was really interesting. At the end of several of those conferences, young men would come up, and those who could speak English and not worry about a translator, and they would say to me, "Then you talked today. You talked to us like a father." "Well, that's nice. What do you mean by that?" The old German pastors, they talk to us like professors. They talk to us about ideas, and they argue with us, and they shout at us, but they never tell us their story. "You tell us your story. You talk to us like a father." I said, "Thank you. That means a lot to me." Fact of the matter was, most of them, I could have been their father. And so then I went back to the United States, and a few days later, I went out to California to speak at a large Asian leadership conference, and all weekend long got to give talks like this one. And when the weekend was over, the convener of the conference got up and he was thanking me, and he said to the people, "All weekend long while Gordon has been talking to us, I've been on the verge of tears." And he said, "It's not because he's that bad a speaker." And then he said, "But then I realized the reason for my tears was that he talks to us like a father. And so many of us feel fatherless." And it was like the Holy Spirit at that moment said, "You just got your call." Because that's what old guys do. If they're responsive to the Holy Spirit, there's a moment when you start being able to talk to people like a father or like a mother. And what do fathers and mothers do? They're tender. They're gentle. They are confident enough that they can open their lives and talk about their struggles and their wounds and their failures. They don't lecture. They don't become pushy. They don't become competitive. They don't necessarily criticize unless they're invited to criticize. That's a whole new call. And with that sense of call, my life came up another notch in my own self-concept as to, where's God leading me for the next years? Because, you know, if you talk to people like a father, you'll always have a job. If you try to compete with the 30, 40-year-olds and tell them how they could do it better, or if they'd only go back and do it the old ways like you used to do it, you'll be rubbed out rather quickly. So the last thing Gail said to me after Alan introduced me this morning was, she put her hand on my arm and she said, "Talk like a father." That's what I'm trying to do. That's a call. And it leads me to ask this question of you. What is your call? When's the last time you tuned in on the call of heaven to what you're doing? Did God really call you to be a pastor? Did he really call you to be a discipler, a trainer of people? Did he really call you to organizational leadership? What has God called you to, not just in function, but in terms of who you are as a person and how you're going to influence the lives of people around you? I want to argue that the call is not a one-time event, but it is constantly being updated like a piece of software in a computer. And if you have not lately defined your call, then my prediction would be that some of that spirit, that reinforcing energy that you and I need to overcome the fatigue, to overcome the sense of blockage and discouragement, then that energy which we need is not going to be there when we need to draw upon it. So lesson one around this wheel is, where are you in the process of your conversion? And secondly, where are you in the freshness of your call? Are the two of those things, are they immediate to you so that they make each morning worth getting up? Because God knows that we're not in this for the money. Well, one or two of you may be, but the rest of us have not found money to be a sufficient motivation to keep on doing this stuff that we're doing. It's got to be something else, and it might as well be the effect of your conversion and the power of your call, because they go together. Now, if I can take you to step two around this wheel. The second great exposure, well, these are not in priority order by any means, but the second exposure in a leader's life that determines whether or not he or she are going to remain effective is this whole question of the vitality of our spiritual life. And some of you may already perceive my little difficulty here, because I'm trying for arbitrary purposes to separate out conversion call from spiritual life and say, for all practical purposes, they're different things, but they certainly do come awfully close together. But what is the nature of one's spiritual life? Again, we're back to Paul's words. Watch your life and doctrine closely so that people can see your progress. Can people see the aliveness of God's Spirit in your life, not simply when you raise holy hands in the midst of a praise service, but so that they see the Spirit of God in your eyes when you talk, the way you touch and handle your children, the way you listen to people when they pour out for you their stories? Do they see spiritual life in the way you handle obstacles, pressures, disappointment? How do you handle those things, and how do those reflect so that other people can see it? Let me take you to a passage of Scripture which has deeply marked me in the last year or two. It comes in Exodus, 34? I don't know why people don't pay more attention to this particular passage. Moses and his people are out around the mountain in the wilderness. The Exodus has happened. Little time has passed. The community is settling in, learning a new way of thinking, living after 400 years of slavery. Then these words, Moses used to take a tent, and he would pitch it outside the camp some distance away, calling it a tent of meeting. I can only assume that Moses wanted this particular tent to be different from other tents where business was carried on, where the politics of the community life were debated and discussed. He wanted this tent to stand out and not be influenced by all the other tents. Moses believed in what I would call sacred space, and the space was delineated as some distance away from the other tents. He called it a tent of meeting. Whenever Moses went out to that tent, all the people stood at the entrances to their tents, watching Moses until he entered the tent. Now, let your imagination run for just a moment. Imagine all these people. I don't know how many people there are. I've heard all kinds of numbers. And they're watching Moses. He generally runs the store or runs the community from the center of everything. But every once in a while, Moses takes a moment to leave his seat where he judges people and carries on all the business life of the community. And he walks toward this tent. And you can almost imagine the whispers of people, Moses is going toward the tent. Moses is going to the tent. What comes to my mind are those feelings that small children have when they see their mother and father embrace and hug and kiss. And sometimes the child wants to get between them because somehow the child understands that in his mother and father's affection, there is safety and the symbols of security, and he wants to be a part of it. And I almost see Israel saying, Moses is going to the tent. Moses is going to the tent. Then the writer goes on. Whenever Moses went into the tent, the pillar of cloud would come down and stay at the entrance while the Lord spoke with Moses. Whenever the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance to the tent, they all stood and worshiped, each at the entrance of his tent. This next sentence is one of the most beautiful sentences in all the Bible, I believe. The Lord would speak to Moses face to face as a man speaks with his friend. I just want to stop there for a moment and savor the flavor of that sentence like a sweet candy in your mouth. The Lord would speak to Moses face to face as a man speaks with his friend. You know, we all probably in this room believe in a gospel that supposedly promises an intimacy with the God of heaven and earth that in one sense comes close to a personal friendship. It's only one of the views of our relationship to God, because if we were only on the basis of friendship, we really probably might not fear God as we ought to. So there have to be other metaphors, but this is a beautiful one. But you wonder how many people experience this. One of my favorite questions to men and women in Christian leadership when we've gotten to know each other well enough that the question can be asked is I'll sometimes say to someone, when do you think in your years you experienced your holiest moments in the presence of God? It's amazing to me how often people really have to struggle with an answer for that question. It hints to me that a lot of us have been for a long time without a Moses-like experience. That we really struggle, and finally when it comes out, maybe once or twice in our lives we can say, I really met him in the tent, and I really knew his presence in an unusual way. But what if Moses' experience is supposed to be something, and I'm trying to be reasonable here, something like a daily occurrence for men and women in Christian leadership? What if we're right now putting our finger on one of the reasons ministry is not working for a lot of people? It's because we don't have many tent-like experiences. What if? The text goes on. Now the writer tells us what friend-to-friend conversation sounds like. Moses said, you've been telling me lead these people, but you've not let me know whom you will send with me. You've said, I know you by name, and if you have found favor with me, if you're pleased with me, teach me your ways so that I may know you and continue to find favor with you. Let me go on. The Lord replied, my presence will go with you, and I will give you rest. Moses then said, if your presence doesn't go with us, don't send us up from here. Moses, brave. How will anyone know that you're pleased with me and with your people unless you go with us? What else will distinguish me and your people from all the other people on the face of the earth? Pull that sentence apart. It is an incredible question, men and women. It's as relevant today as it was then. What else will distinguish me and your people from all the other people on the face of the earth if your presence is not with us? Ask yourself if the contemporary Christian church in the Western world is operating according to the logic of that sentence. I all too often fear that I and my brothers and sisters have fallen into the trap of saying, the world will know us by the size of our buildings, by our ability to put on spiffy TV programs, by the cuteness of sermons. Somehow Moses understands that the only way he's going to lead those people through a very, very difficult wilderness transit is if the presence of God is so real that not only do they know it, but their enemies know it. The conversation goes on. The Lord said to Moses, I'll do the very thing you've asked because I am pleased with you and I know you by name. Moses isn't through. Then Moses said, okay, show me your glory. What does that mean? I would suggest to you that in modern parlance, the word glory is easily translated power. The glory of a nation, in one sense, I'm not sure I'm proud of this, a glory of a nation is in its military might. The ships it puts to sea, the planes it flies in the air, the size of its army and their equipment. And one of the ways one country intimidates another is it puts its military strength on parade. Moses is saying, I've got to know whether or not your glory, your power, is sufficient to face the power of all the enemies we're going to have on this trip. The Amalekites, the Anakites, and all the other ites. The Lord said, I'll cause all my goodness to pass in front of you. I will proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence. I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, compassion on whom I will have compassion. But you can't see my face, for no one can see me and live. So Moses has really asked three questions. Show me your intentions, guarantee your presence, and show me your power. You know, Moses is pretty smart. As a leader, he knows that if he doesn't have those three things going for him, he can't make a success out of this run to the promised land. And that's the negotiation he has with God. And when he comes out of the tent of meeting, he apparently comes out with confidence and assurance that these things are in place. Let me ask you, where's your tent? And what goes on in the tent? And are the questions that concern you and your spiritual agenda even close to the model that Moses gives to us in this particular passage? This is what keeps Moses going over the next 39, 40 years when he puts up with all that stuff on being part of one of the most belligerent communities that has ever existed. Allow me to go there for just a minute and kind of a bunny track to the side. Has it ever occurred to you what it's like to try to lead a group of people who have had 400 years in slavery? How many generations, 400 years? I don't know, maybe 15, 20 generations? Do you have any appreciation of what slavery over a long period of time does to people? It denies them self-worth, it makes them indecisive, it makes them suspicious, it makes them not trust leaders, it makes them not work together, it diminishes their whole will to live. You see all of those symptoms in Israel for the next several generations. What Moses did was absolutely incredible. That he could, you know, another phrase we use in the U.S. every once in a while, it was like leading a herd of cats. And in one sense, you can reinterpret the entire Older Testament when you understand that the Older Testament from the Exodus on is all about liberating people from a mentality of slavery. And it even carries on in the New Testament, in the book of Romans, where Paul uses the whole metaphor of slavery to explain salvation. Slavery was uppermost in the minds of the Jewish people for centuries. And Moses has to deal with that slavery mentality. And if he doesn't know the intentions of God, if he doesn't have the presence of God, if he doesn't have the glory or the power of God, he just can't do this. It's impossible. And I want to say to you today, that's one of the great exposures of the Christian leader, is that I'm not sure that any of us, beginning with myself, fully know this or appreciate it. And that's what Oswald Chambers was concerned about. I meet this man who was once a man of God, and now I meet him 10 years later. He has lost it. And he's trying to do ministry without a spiritual life that is full and responds to those three questions. Now, let me take just a few minutes to really detour here, because I'm going to go away not feeling like I've said adequately enough about this. Let me show you, first of all, something that's wonderful out of Christian history. I'm sure everybody is aware of the name of William and Catherine Booth, 19th century Victorians who founded the Salvation Army. Some of you may not know the wonderful love story between the two of them, William and Catherine. Catherine stays most of the time in London at their home, starting to raise children. William is traveling incessantly, so there are large periods of time when they're separated from each other in the early days. He's going from English town to English town, preaching the gospel, trying to win people to Christ, to establish his ministry. And there's no cell phones, there's no email, there's no way of communicating. All they've got is letters, and we've got all those letters, so at least the Salvation Army does. Here's William, young man, very discouraged. I have a constant load at my chest and a weight on my head. He writes, a newly converted girl wept sorely and appeared in great distress and to have much rejoiced when she got a hope. In other words, she came forward at one of his services and got saved. But I hear she was dancing away Thursday and Friday in the marketplace with half the town looking on. I have many thoughts about this kind of converted people, indeed many temptations about the whole affair. I find so few who seem to me to live Christianly. Who is there? Shades of Elijah. I'm the only one in the world who bowed his knee to the Lord. I mean, William Booth, he's this discouraged. He writes on another day, just devastatingly lonely. He writes to Catherine, I want your company, your comfort, your consoling conversation. I want you to hear me, to criticize me, to urge me on. I feel such a desperate sense of loneliness, so oppressive to my spirit. I speak and preach and act, and it's passed over. There's no one with whom I can talk about my performance. To others, I cannot mention it for fear of being thought egotistic or seeking for praise. And for some reason, others say little or nothing of it to me. I hear only of it by hints and innuendos. And then he says, and I want you too to help you, to make you happy, to bring you flowers, to show you my friends, for you to enjoy the sunshine with me and the landscape and the Sabbath and sweet days. Bless you, I was never made to enjoy anything alone. Oh, that we could only meet for a time, but we must wait. On another letter, he's so low. I wonder whether I could get something to do in London of some kind, some secretaryship or something respectable that would keep us going. He wants to quit. I know how difficult such things are to obtain without a friend or influence, as I'm fixed. But we must hope against hope, I suppose. This is a young man, and his soul is empty. He's hurting. His spiritual life is dried out. Now watch Catherine spring into motion. This is Catherine Booth. Oh, my love, I have felt acutely about you. I mean your soul. I rejoice exceedingly to hear how the Lord is blessing your labors, but as I stand at a distance and contemplate the scene of action and all the circumstances attending it, I tremble. I know how possible it is to preach and pray and sing and even shout while the heart is not right with God. I know how popularity and prosperity have a tendency to elate and exalt self if the heart is not humble before God. I know how Satan takes advantage of these things to work out the destruction, if possible, of one whom the Lord uses to pull down strongholds of his kingdom. And all these considerations make me tremble and weep and pray for you, my dearest love, that you may be able to overcome all of his devices, and having done all to stand, not in your own strength, but in humble dependence upon him who worketh all in all. Tell me, my love, in your next letter, all about your soul's secret experiences. Tell me whether you attend faithfully to private prayer, how you feel when alone with God. This is the surest test by which to judge of your state, and you never needed it more frequently than now. The harassing turmoil of business might be less congenial, but depend upon it, my dear, it was not more dangerous to your soul's true interest. It was not more necessary to watch and pray then than it is now. If you can get yours quite right with God and keep it so, nothing will hinder you from being a useful man, and I believe God will signally own you as his servant. But if you keep back anything from God, if you suffer self to share the glory, he will frustrate your designs and spoil your happiness. Catherine was 23 years of age when she wrote those words. Thank you. 23 years old. I think them to be some of the greatest words in all of modern Christian literature. You read the letters of Catherine Booth to William, written at such a young age, and you say, what have we lost in 100 years? What have we lost? But what Catherine is trying to tell William is if your soul is not filled, if your spiritual life is not vigorous, then it's not surprising that more than a few of us dry out in our midlife because we can't keep going on natural enthusiasm and idealism and physical energy. It just doesn't work that way. And Catherine knows that, and she's scared to death that William might forget it. I found this just the other day about Martin Luther. Luther prayed 4 hours a day, not despite his busy life, but because only so that he could accomplish his gigantic labors. To work without praying and without listening means only to grow and spread oneself upward, without striking roots and without creating an equivalent in the earth. A person who works this way is living unnaturally. We have a long way to go, don't we? And it challenges me to recognize that this is the kind of work we have to do. In my shower at home each morning as I shower, I have a list of things that I want to remind myself in the renewing of my own spirit. I use a monastic phrase, my dailies, as things that I want to turn my spirit to as early in the morning as possible. I want to remind myself that each day in the renewing of my conversion and call that I must return to the cross and renew my conversion. I must remember my potential for both good and evil. I must measure my character in terms of Christ-likeness. I must reaffirm my devotion to my family and my friends. I must renounce resentment and commit to peacemaking with all people. I must do right things according to a standard of excellence. I must be sensitive and generous to the weak, and I must live in anticipation of the coming of Jesus. That does it for me. You might have your own list. But these are the things that lead us toward the possibility of a full spirit and the recognition that our spiritual lives are vital. Now, in the last 11 minutes that I've got, let me take you to a third point on the wheel and suggest to you that the third great exposure of leaders comes in the area of seeing leadership as stewardship. This could be one of the real sleepers around the wheel, one of those that too many people bypass because it doesn't seem at the moment to be significant, but it could be the one that bites the most over the long haul. Because what I'm trying to say here is that all too often, the leader, as time goes by, begins to assume that he or she owns their ministry and all of the assets in that ministry. What in the world do I mean by that? Well, first, a biblical example. No one exemplifies the wrong kind of leadership in this sense than Saul, the first king of Israel. He gets picked and he moves into motion, but little bit by little, you begin to see everything go wrong for Saul. He's jealous of a younger man. He feels like he's entitled to the job of king, and he will do anything, even scurrilous things, to hold on to it. And little bit by little, he loses control of the thing he loves the most, and he dies in disgrace. When Alan introduced me, he was kind enough to remember the book Ordering Your Private World, and he was right. If the book has enjoyed success, it's probably because of one or two chapters. Most of all, the two chapters about called and driven people. And in the book I used Saul as the example of a person who is driven, who wants to own their ministry, own their leadership, own the people. And you all too often see this, especially as men, I don't know about women yet, but men grow older. When they reach about my age, you discover that many, many men in ministry can't let go. And little bit by little, even as they become more and more effective, they are difficult to dislodge, even though they're beginning to damage the very thing they built up. Because they want to hold on to something. And then you realize, as you look into their lives, that they have so identified with their leadership that if you take the leadership away, they cease to exist. Fortunately, I guess in my own life, I saw this one too many times, and I began to say to Gail years ago, we have got to hold our ministry loosely. First of all, so that God can change it anytime he wants. But secondly, when it comes time to step away from public life, that we will know who we are apart from what we are when the spotlight goes on. And one has to think about that all the way through their lives. In Ordering Your Private World, I picked on the story of John the Baptizer as the great example of the called person. In John chapter 3, there are people who go to John and they say, John, we've noticed that suddenly all these crowds that came to hear you preach are now going to hear him. And you got nobody to preach to anymore. And you have this really interesting paragraph that a lot of people don't know much about, but in effect, it's John's answer to what happens when you lose your job. And that's the test of whether or not a man or a woman really understands the stewardship of their ministry. How do you handle things when you lose your job? We see too many men and women in their 60s and 70s who are at the end stages of their public ministry, and they become bitter and angry, and they become filled with self-pity. Because they can't let go. And then you discover that they needed the ministry more than the ministry needed them. Not so with John. Look at John's words. He says, a man can receive nothing unless it has been given to him from heaven. That's stewardship. It's John saying, in effect, you know, yeah, I did preach to large crowds for several months. But I always looked at the crowd as a group of people that God gave me to preach to. They were never mine. And if God wants to move the crowds in another direction toward Jesus, that's just fine with me. I never owned them in the first place. That's the difference between an owner in ministry and a steward in ministry. The owner thinks he can control. The steward says, I'll do what the owner wants me to do until he wants me to stop doing it. You and I do not own our ministries. We don't own the people to whom we preach and whom we disciple. They are God's, and God can do anything with them he wants. Cardinal Danneels of Belgium has a wonderful phrase. I have to paraphrase it because he says, each night when I leave my bishop's offices and I go to my consistory or my home, I kneel at my private altar and I say, God, is this ministry yours or mine? And God says, it's mine. And then the cardinal says, and then I say, well, Lord, if it's yours, then I can go to sleep and have a good rest tonight, and I will pick up my responsibilities again in the morning. Love that phrase. And that's John. The crowds were never mine. And if God wants to take them another direction, I'm pleased with that. Then he goes on, you yourselves bear me witness. I have always told you I am not the Christ. John not only knew who he was, he knew who he wasn't. At the peak of his success, people came to John and they said, are you a reincarnated Elijah? I mean, you're so good at what you do. Some said, are you the great prophet that Moses predicted was going to come? And some apparently even said to him, is there any chance that you're the Christ? Don't underestimate that question. I wouldn't be surprised if there were a few nights when John, who was a sinner like all of us, went to sleep and thought, this was a great day. I was really good today. All those people who came forward, we couldn't keep up with all the baptisms. Maybe I am the Christ. Have some of you ever had one of those moments where it's gone so well and you can just feel the swelledness of the heart, the head growing? And we begin to lose touch with who we really are. One night I give a banquet speech. Gail's with me. It's gone well. Everybody loved my jokes. I only have about 4 jokes. They love my stories. My points all clicked. People said, at the right time. On the way home, I say to Gail in the car, have you ever thought about how really, truly few great communicators there are in the world? And she says, yes, there's one less than you think there is. We have a whole industry out there of image makers, and they affect our culture, and people will play with your image and mine. And they will find ways to convince you that you're somebody that you're not. And it's real exposure for a leader to never forget or not to forget who he or she really is. It's not unusual for people when Gail and I are someplace and I'm going to be speaking and someone will very kindly come up, how do you want to be introduced? And they have this biographical thing that they've asked for you to send them ahead of time. And it tells about everything you ever did in life. And they have that, and you say, well, don't read that, please. Well, how do you want to be introduced? And I find myself saying, the 3 appropriate things you could introduce me with would be to say, he's a husband, he's a father, and he's a sinner, in whatever order you want to say those things. But that's the most accurate thing you can say. Everything else really is not that important. And so sometimes people get up and they'll say, well, Gordon has asked me to introduce him as a husband and a father and a sinner. And everybody laughs. Isn't that cute? But it's deadly true. It's really all we have going for us. And that's why I love John the Baptizer so much, is that he understood this. And he was not going to allow people to puff up his image any more than reality said it would be. John goes on. He who has the bride has the bridegroom. But the friend is the friend of the bride who stands and hears him and rejoices greatly at the bridegroom's voice. In other words, John says, you have to understand, I not only knew that I was a steward, and I not only understood who I was and wasn't, but I also understood my role. I've been nothing ever than the best man at the groom's wedding. My job has always been to point out who the celebrity is in the wedding. And if you see the crowd going after Jesus, the good news is I've done my work well. I've pointed them toward the Lord. And then he comes with this great, incredible statement. And therefore, this joy of mine is fulfilled, for he must increase and I must decrease. This, ladies and gentlemen, is spiritual life. This does not come out of the head. It comes from the heart. It comes from a soul so filled with the Spirit of God. And that not just because someone has had a deeply emotional experience at some meeting, but because day by day by day, they go to the tent. And in the presence of the Lord, asking the right questions, getting the appropriate answers, this is the kind of mentality and spiritual perspective that comes as a result over the years. It keeps a person fresh. It keeps them moving ahead. It keeps them getting better and better at what they're doing as the years go by. So there are 3 exposures to the leader so far that we've looked at. A life in which conversion and call is real and dynamic. A life in which spiritual life is vital and moving every day. And a life of stewardship, which makes me understand that I operate day by day at the bidding of the Spirit, using his assets for his purposes. In this way, I am cut free from a spirit of ownership and a spirit of stubbornness and greed that makes me match myself with other people and grow jealous or envious or dissatisfied, whatever the case may be. When we come back from lunch and we've had our little naps, we'll keep going around this wheel. God be with you.